This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Perhaps the most compelling part of yesterday's report on the Columbia shuttle disaster was its portrait of people making critical decisions under stress. Of course, everyone at NASA was and is concerned about safety, but the report concluded that a combination of political and operational pressure and chronic underfunding overrode safety, and maybe most importantly, it showed how managers allowed repeated success to undermine their judgment. That falling foam had never been a problem before, so they assumed it never would be. There was also an unflattering picture of the chief decision-maker, the program manager. Extremely talented, yes, but something of a know-it-all, who perhaps unconsciously intimidated underlings who had awkward questions. We're going to focus today on decisions and safety. How can organizations involved in inherently risky business change to emphasize safety and still get the job done? We'll talk with people who've made decisions that put other people at risk, a doctor, a military officer, and a foreign editor. And we want to hear from those of you who faced such critical professional decisions under pressure with less than perfect information. Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK, and our email address is totn@npr.org. Later in the program, what do Indiana Jones and the Mata Hari have in common? And we'll continue our visits with people who helped organize the historic March on Washington, which celebrates its 40th anniversary tomorrow. But first, making good decisions in difficult workplace situations. Joining us from her office in Los Angeles, California, is Los Angeles Times Foreign Desk Editor Marjorie Miller, and welcome to Talk of the Nation.
Thank you very much.
You have to decide, among other things, whether or not to send reporters into dangerous situations, well, maybe not every day, but often.
I do, and of course, they are the ones who make those decisions with us, but it's getting more and more dangerous all around the world, so it's not getting easier.
I understand you just made the decision, maybe with the reporter, not to send somebody to Chechnya.
I did, in part because the reporter is new on the beat, and I think it's very important to get the judgment of the reporter on the ground. And she's only been in Moscow for about a month, and I thought it would be better for her to wait, and rather than relying on other people's opinions about whether or not it was a safer time to go, to be able to form more of a judgment of her own.
One of the reasons I wanted to talk with a foreign editor is I've been in your situation, an analogous time. It was Somalia, and I had to make the decision about sending people in there and about where they were going to go once they were in there. And of course, as you suggest, often they make those decisions for you sometimes. And it's much more difficult to send people into those circumstances than it is to go yourself.
Yes, I think it is. First of all, when it's you, you feel like you're making a calculated risk, and you always know at any given moment that you're all right or what danger you might be facing. But when you're 3 or 10,000 miles away, you don't have that minute-by-minute assessment. I think that foreign correspondents, by and large, are weighing the risks much more often. The dangers now are not as they were when I was, for example, in Central America and you were covering a more conventional war. Even though it was a guerrilla war, you had two armies out there and you more or less knew when you were taking risks, whether it was crossing a line or moving into a territory held by the other side. But now, of course, you're taking those risks going to a press conference at the UN headquarters in Baghdad or going to the Marriott in Jakarta. And I think it's a little more complicated.
Did you make the decision on whether or not to leave people in Baghdad at the start of the war?
Yes. Well, we did make that decision. And we had a reporter, John Danishevsky, who had covered Iraq on and off for several years. He wanted to stay. And we felt that it was a big hole in the coverage of the Gulf War last time that reporters were not able to be on the ground. And if we had the opportunity this time, we wanted to stay there to provide a picture of the other side. I made that decision with him and, of course, with the editor of the paper, John Carroll.
You can do everything right, and you can weigh all the risks, and still something can go wrong. We think of Daniel Pearl. All of us think about Daniel Pearl. And do you sit up nights sometimes worrying about the consequences of the decisions you make?
Oh, you bet I do. I wake up at night. We had 25 people covering the war, and it was very worrisome because you never knew where the danger was going to be. It might have been in Baghdad, but it might have been in northern Iraq, or it might have been with the reporters who were embedded with the troops, or it might have been in Jerusalem if, in fact, you know, it was as we believe that they had chemical weapons that the Iraqi government could file at Israel or surrounding countries. But again, it could be anywhere. It could be in Chicago today covering,
sure,
you know, the warehouse shooting, or it could be somewhere we're not thinking of in Paris or London.
Would you want anybody making those decisions who had not been there themselves on one level or another?
I think it helps to be there. But again, it changes. Just, you know, I covered Central America, but that doesn't necessarily qualify my judgments for Iraq. I think what we have done since Daniel Pearl's killing is try to equip all of our reporters better to make those decisions. We're all sending them to a kind of training that they didn't get before in not only first aid, but in recognizing certain kinds of weapons fire and what to do in situations like that, and what to do in situations where you might be kidnapped or if you're kidnapped. So it's a very fluid situation.
And well, I don't envy you. It's an awful situation to be in. Thanks very much.
You're welcome.
Marjorie Miller is the foreign editor for the Los Angeles Times, and she joined us from her office in Los Angeles. Joining us now from his office in Washington, D.C. is the Assistant Secretary of Labor for Occupational Safety and Health, John Henshaw, and it's good of you to be with us on Talk of the Nation.
Glad to be here, Neil.
What can organizations do? And there are all kinds of different organizations, as different as a newspaper and as different as NASA, but what can organizations do to foster a culture of smart decision-making?
Well, first of all, I think it's a collaborative process, which means you engage all the people involved in the risk assessment and managing the risk, making sure they have proper input into the process, and then make judgments as to what's an acceptable risk and what's not.
Is smart decision-making the most important part of workplace safety?
It's not only smart decision-making, but also it's gathering the appropriate data. You know, certainly when we deal with workplace safety and health, we must look at all the appropriate scientific data and then judge whether, in fact, what the probability is of an adverse outcome, and then making the decision as to what is acceptable to the employees in that workplace.
As you do businesses, you know, widely varied, you know, and risks as different as, you know, carpal tunnel syndrome and falling off a construction project and all kinds of different things. As you evaluate these kinds of risks and the kinds of decision making that goes into what kind of, you know, you can never be perfect.
Well, that's correct. And we're dealing with probabilities. We're dealing with unknowns, although we try to eliminate as many of the unknowns as we can by gathering research and data to make a good decision. But yeah, there are probabilities that we must contend with.
And you also have to deal with the realities of the workplace. The project must be finished. The bridge has to be completed. There's pressures all the time to get things done on time.
Well, it's not only just the productivity, but also the economics. You know, we are obligated to look at the feasibility, what is feasible, what is economically feasible, not only as well as, you know, what is the scientific data in respect to adverse outcomes. So we must weigh all of those to make a risk management decision.
Do people in these situations have the obligation to explain to their workers what kind of risks they're being asked to take?
To the extent they know what those risks are. And that's why it is appropriate for every workplace to really have a thorough discussion of the risk and understand it completely so that they can convey it to the worker. But even with the best laid minds working on the issue, you don't always, or you can't always predict what the risk might be or what the outcomes might be.
John Henshaw, thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you.
John Henshaw is Assistant Secretary of Labor for Occupational Safety and Health, and he joined us from his office here in Washington, D.C. With us now in Studio 3A is a former assistant to the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, retired Major General Mike Davidson. It's always good to have you on the program, Mike. Welcome
back.
Thanks,
Neil. It's good to be back.
As opposed to not knowing in broad terms what the risk is, military officers facing a situation of war to some degree do know what the risk is.
Well, we do, and you can expect to do a shuttle mission without catastrophic loss of life, but unfortunately, when you undertake a military mission, there will be losses. That doesn't make it easier, but it gives you a chance to steel yourself and to prepare for it.
As you just heard the OSHA administrator tell us what organizations can do to foster good decision-making, does that bear any relation to what you were familiar with in the military?
Not a great deal, frankly. The best you can do in the military business, because missions are not optional. The mission is going to go forward. What you try to do is stack the deck in favor of getting the troops home and in one piece, and that can be done. You can stack the deck to get the guys home.
At what risk, though? You're risking the mission?
We don't like to think of it that way, but there is some element of that, frankly. The priority is supposed to be mission men's self. I don't know anyone that got to a senior level in the military that didn't, on one occasion or another in combat, put the well-being of their soldiers ahead of the mission. I certainly know I did.
That question that I was talking to Marjorie Miller about people who have been there making the decisions, you came into the military at the time of Vietnam, right?
I did, and we don't have any generals who are lateral entries into the military. Everybody comes up as a private or a sergeant or a lieutenant. So that would be akin to having every senior NASA administrator having been an astronaut. That won't work at NASA, but it does work in the military.
Let's take a phone call. Our number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Our email address is totn@npr.org. And Mike joins us on the line from Baltimore, Maryland.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm a truck driver, and this issue of safety is chronic, and I've been thinking about it all week as this Challenger thing has been going on. Because in this industry, safety is the first thing that's put out to the public and the last thing that matters when the load has to get there. It's just safety is expensive. It's extremely time-consuming. Today, right now, as we speak, I'm sitting under a load with an expired inspection that I was told had to get here because the box has to go on the ship. It's a time thing, and it does not matter if a brake is out of adjustment, if this or that is wrong, but the load's got to be there, then the load's got to be there. And they're able to shunt the responsibility off of this, in the trucking industry at least, by saying, well, that's the driver's responsibility. The driver is responsible for the safety of the equipment and the time and the this and the that. But the driver is under chronic pressure. People need to keep their jobs. I own my own truck. I can move along as I want. But I still need to make a living. And the pressure is extremely intense.
And you're driving past school buses full of kids.
And I'm driving past school buses full of kids. Mom in the minivan, dad in the this or the that. Of course, there's the whole other issue of people working on their computers while they're going down the road, but that's another thing.
Can you override your bosses?
You can, but then you risk your job. One way around it is to pull in to find an enforcement officer and have them write you a ticket.
Boy, there's a positive alternative.
Yeah, I mean, that's really your only alternative. If you say no, if you refuse it, then you go to the bottom of the list. You don't get the work. You might lose your job. You go to an enforcement officer. It still goes on my license. Might go against their safety record, but it's on my license. And if something does happen going down the road, I'm the one who did it.
I think what we're finding, Mike, is there are no easy answers, and I think that's what we heard yesterday in that Columbia. I made the mistake myself a couple of times. You said Challenger was the Columbia. But thanks very much for the call. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
Good luck. We're going to continue taking your calls when we come back from a short break. 800-989-8255. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're discussing how workplace culture can encourage or discourage good decision-making If your workplace culture helps you make effective decisions, we'd like to hear why, and if not, why not? Give us a call, 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Our email address is totn@npr.org. Our guest here in Studio 3A is retired General Mike Davidson. And Mike, again, going back to the military context, as you say, timing is not an option. It has to go ahead. It's difficult to make decisions. Does the military run into problems with officers who get paralyzed by an inability to decide?
Yes. It doesn't happen often, but it happens, and those officers are relieved as quickly as it becomes apparent, because you put your troops at risk even more of an indecisive commander.
You tend to think of, you go back to history for lessons, and General McClellan during the Civil War, a man said to love his troops so much he would not risk them in battle. His boss, President Lincoln, said, put another way, he said he had a case of the slows.
Well, that's correct, and if McClellan had remained in command, we'd still be fighting the Civil War today.
Let's get another caller, and Tim joins us on the line from Washington, D.C.
Hi, how are you doing?
Okay.
Yeah, I spent a number of years whitewater rafting on some pretty large whitewater, and it was a situation where basically, every decision when you got into the big stuff was a life or death decision. And, it's a company obviously in a situation oriented towards risk. But, given that it was a part of the game...
It sells risk in a way, doesn't it?
Oh, absolutely. And people live for it. I mean, they almost don't have as fun a time if you don't flip the raft going down the river. And yet, there's danger under every rock. I mean, I discovered on occasion that I had rafted by a point where someone had flipped a few minutes before and there was actually a body stuck underneath of a rock. And it's disturbing, but, it's part of the game. And I think you were saying earlier about how risk is inherent in, like the shuttle program. I mean, what they're doing is pushing the boundaries of physics, and accidents are going to happen no matter how careful you are.
Yeah, but that's experimentation. That's exploration. We sort of expect some degree of risk there, at least the astronauts do. And your customers, though, I mean, they may expect an adrenaline rush, but they don't expect to drown.
They sign a waiver at the beginning that says that they waive all responsibility for injury for the company. I mean, they don't expect to drown, but the possibility exists. And they go out there with that understanding, and we make it explicitly clear. And of course, our objective is not to have that happen. That's
sure.
True. But what we're doing is definitely taking a very big risk going out into really potentially lethal whitewater. But no, it's certainly not the objective. But it's what people are looking for, and it's an inherent part of the job. And the companies take great efforts to make sure that people are safe with training and with precautions. And when you get onto a serious river, smaller, lighter weight rivers, there can be a pettiness and a competitiveness between the companies. And, our company is better than your company. But when you get into serious whitewater on serious rivers, the company differentiations don't matter. If somebody's in trouble, you help. Hmm. Even if you're a private boater out there, you stop and you help.
Well, you'd still do it, Tim?
Yeah, on occasion. Yeah. I still do.
Yeah. Well, good luck.
Thanks.
Right. Bye-bye. General Davidson, one of the differences, again, the military has, even if everything goes right, it's likely that something bad is going to happen. Does the military train officers to accept the consequences of their decisions?
No, there's no training program for dealing with casualties, but a part of our culture is to take care of the troops. It comes out in a lot of daily ways. Officers eat after their soldiers. Officers go home after their soldiers go home. These are the kids that we've taken responsibility for. We clothe them, house them, feed them, lead them into combat. So it's a part of our culture that those lives are precious, and you just look out for them as best you can.
General Davidson, thanks very much for being with us. We appreciate it.
Thank you, Neil.
Retired General Mike Davidson here with us in Studio 3A wanted to read this email that we just got from Gordon Williams. My most recent decision, upon which the lives of my coworkers and subordinates depended, was on September the 11th. I was transportation consultant then and was working on a project out of the 86th floor of the World Trade Center's North Tower. The evacuation procedure that only existed as a result of the 93 bombing was to wait at your current location until notified to do otherwise. I'm glad I made the decision to get my team out of there before waiting for contact, because the building collapsed minutes later. As far as I know, no official evacuation calls were ever made. Let's continue our discussions now. And joining us is Dan Shapiro. Dan Shapiro is an assistant professor of clinical psychiatry at the University of Arizona in the College of Medicine. He's the author of the book Delivering Dr. Amelia, and he joins us from his office in Tucson, Arizona. It's good to have you back on the program.
Oh, nice to talk to you, Neil.
In your psychology practice, you see a lot of doctors. And doctors are another group of people that make a lot of critical decisions under a lot of pressure and often, perhaps too often, without perfect information. How do they make their decisions?
Well, I think some of them do it, really well and compartmentalize completely from the rest of their lives. And others, for example, I know an anesthesiologist who gets nauseous and has diarrhea before every case, really struggle. Interestingly, actually, I think it's not the decisions you see on television in, ER and that sort of thing that really lead physicians to agonize. I think more it's the Sophie's choices where there's two impossible options available and, neither one seems particularly good.
As I read through the report yesterday of the Columbia incident and the decision-making process that involved the program manager, it did remind me of a hotshot young producer I once knew who was arrogant and thought he knew everything and could do everybody's job better than they can do. But to some degree, you can make decisions unless you think like that.
Well, I think that's an interesting point. On one hand, as patients, we all want the physician who has incredible authority as they speak. But I think there's a difference between, the metaphor I use is like being on a ship. I think there's a big difference between being on a ship with a captain who has great authority and says, you know what, we are steering away from the iceberg, than it is to feel like you're the one at the wheel and the captain is somewhere far away and it's not really going to influence them, or that they're somehow inoculated from mistakes or even intimidating.
Even intimidating, that's the other part of that thing that comes up, intimidating, the junior engineers were raising awkward questions and she intimidated them.
I think that is the mark of a good physician, someone who is, it's certainly in a teaching situation, able to nurture the younger physicians along so that they really hear all the data about their patients. And earlier, John Henshaw mentioned gathering data. Mm-hmm. And I think that is one of the areas where we struggle quite a bit in medicine because there's so much fear from learning from mistakes that we often suppress this kind of white coat of secrecy, and we don't get all the information we need. If there's a problem with this culture, I think that's one of them.
Let's take another caller, and Maura is on the line with us from Los Angeles.
Hi, Neil. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
One thing that really struck me when you were talking about the culture at NASA is I'm a retired firefighter. And oftentimes we would find ourselves in a precarious situation with a hazardous materials fire, even though we did inspections and we knew there might have been some research going on that might produce some untenable environments. I think the trouble is you have a lieutenant who says, well, we've got to put it out. There's a crowd. When your money is dependent on the public, they want to see you get in there and do something, and they don't understand the danger. So somebody makes a decision, you go into a fire you can't fight with water, and 6 months later, your firefighters are all contracting bizarre forms of cancer. And this actually occurred, I believe, in New York. And I think the thing that struck me was that there seems to be a similarity in a, it's a cultural identification, it's a safety culture. And it really comes down to priority, and what is your priority? Public approval, keeping NASA on schedule, putting your fires out, keeping your public happy, or keeping your people alive.
There is also, and you may have been in a perfect position to observe it, Maura, there's a certain macho. I mean, if people are going to take risks, you develop a certain attitude because you're taking those risks. On the other hand, you don't want cowboys, do you?
That's true, and there's a certain amount of critical thinking that goes on now in the fire service that I was privileged to be a part of, being that fire departments are becoming a little bit more progressive. And still, you have some old-school folks, male or female, it's a philosophy thing, it's not necessarily a gender thing,
mm-hmm.
And these are folks that just want to go in and get it done and put it out and do the hard thing and then, have a cup of coffee afterwards, and the trouble is it really doesn't take in consideration the complexities of our new environments.
Hmm. You're a retired firefighter. How come?
Everything that we're talking about. I just didn't feel safe. The more we did inspections, I worked in Boulder, Colorado, and there's a tremendous amount of pharmaceutical research going on. And the more we did inspections, the more I realized if you're working with a lieutenant that is unfamiliar with this, I would be the first person to say, we can't go in there. And if you don't have support, then you end up getting written up. And it, I was looking at a lot, you know, I would have chosen to be insubordinate to save my life. And I thought, you know, I'm not sure I'm ready to be a part of an organization where I can't fully commit, and I don't know if I can do enough as an individual to change it at this point. So I just felt that the risks outweighed the benefits at a certain point, and I retired.
Well, Maura, thank you very much for the call. That's very interesting. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Thank you very much.
Okay. And Dr. Shapiro, you know, talking about the firefighters and the macho culture a little bit, I couldn't help but be reminded of surgeons. And these are people who need to have an awful lot of confidence, because if you don't have confidence, how can you possibly reach for that scalpel and make that cut?
Well, you know, that's really interesting that you say that, Neil. I know a surgeon who teaches all of his training physicians to appear as if they know what's going on, even if they're panicking inside. I mean, that's a major part of the culture.
And how did, you know, again, there's training, but once they get out of their training and they're in the, you know, a lot of them are in private practice, there's no organizational support for them, is there?
For most of them, no. And in fact, reaching out to other physicians is acculturated away during their training. I mean, they're really taught to be completely self-reliant, and any asking for help is something that's kind of looked at with, you know, askance.
Is that a problem?
I think it's a major problem. I mean, I think we're teaching our young physicians that self-denial and self-reliance is more important than relationship and self-knowledge, which is, you know, really what I'd like to see.
Let's get another caller. Emily joins us now on the line from Anchorage in Alaska.
Hi. I'm wondering why doctors are put under so much pressure during their residencies if they have to make life and death decisions.
Did you get to hear that, Dr. Shapiro?
I did. I mean, I think that's a terrific question, and there is a movement in medicine to really change the number of hours that residents are working, but, you know, it has a long way to go before it's really embraced by the larger culture. And I think you have to trace back physicians' training to understand how this has evolved. It's really kind of this behemoth that would be really useful to address and change. The caller makes a good point.
I'm wondering what the rationale is at all, though. I mean, is it some kind of, like, I can't think of the word right now, but
well, the rationalization
to initiate them or something.
The rationalization we often hear is that, you know, if you're only on every fourth night, then you're missing three-quarters of the good cases and you're not learning like you're supposed to. But we know that physicians who are sleep-deprived, for example, start to resemble people who are drunk. So, I mean, you're raising a really good issue.
There is an aspect of initiation, almost hazing to it, but wasn't it also the theory that, you know, if you can learn to make these decisions under the most adverse conditions possible, you'll develop confidence in your ability to make these decisions throughout your career?
If we only did that to folks who are kind of in those circumstances, you know, people who are going to be up all night, like heart surgeons or that sort of thing, then I would totally agree and that would make complete sense. But we don't. We do it to training physicians all across the specialties.
Emily, good question. Thanks very much for the phone call.
Okay, thanks.
Bye-bye. We're talking about decision-making and safety, and you're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let's talk now with Lawrence, who's with us from Eugene, Oregon.
Yes. I work the Alaska Pipeline.
Mm-hmm.
One of the safest major projects ever. And the reason was not the companies, the separate contractors. The reason was that the unions impressed upon their men, the guy on the ground, that his safety was up to him and that he had to make those decisions and that, in fact, he could stop the job if he felt it was unsafe. I think that the decision has got to be given back to the guy on the ground. You were talking to a truck driver a little while ago. Those safety decisions got to be in the hands of the guy in the seat.
Yet he was under a lot of pressure to get the box to the ship on time. My recollection of the Alaska Pipeline, one of the most controversial things about it, was that all of the contracts were cost plus. The pressure was a little bit less.
Well, it might have been less, but we lost very few people on that job, and if it had been left up to the companies, the push would have been for production and not safety. And the credit for that goes to the unions and the men on the ground.
Well, Lawrence, thanks very much, and appreciate your call.
Mm-hmm.
Let's see if we get one more call in. And John is with us from Lander, Wyoming.
Hi, Neil.
Hi.
Yeah, I work with the National Outdoor Leadership School, and we trained the Columbia crew in the mountains for 12 days.
Really?
Yeah, as we did a lot of risk assessment as well as climbing peaks and making the transferences from wilderness on Earth to wilderness in space. One of the points I guess I'd like to make is looking at organizational culture, both in an organization as my own or others that deal with risk, is that it's often common within a hierarchy like this to develop a fear culture that dissuades the questioning of decisions. And I'm not saying that that's what's happened with NASA at this point, but just looking at that, we look at a culture that gets a lot of their actions as a result of not questioning the decisions that get made by those people on the front ground, as your last caller was talking about.
Mm-hmm.
And then also, looking on a larger scale with American culture, we do find at the same time in our business, America loves the Mountain Dew commercial without any of the hazards that or the outcomes that can happen.
Mm-hmm.
Because of that. And we tend to want to look to find a blame when something goes wrong or a scapegoating versus looking and accepting risk for its inherent sake of risk.
Neil, if I could respond.
Sure, go ahead.
One of the things that's occurred to me is that the mark of a healthy culture is one that aggressively studies its mistakes. And certainly in medicine, one of the major problems we have is that there is this fear culture where people are encouraged not to talk about or explore their mistakes. And that's one of the things that I'd really like to see, you know, move to be different.
Yeah, I would also agree with that. It's been, you know, through our own experiences in our programs that a diligent assessment of decisions that are being made on the ground and on the field really play to the outcomes. Otherwise, we get in a situation where we start to have complacency towards the risk, and that's when the issues happen. You know,
and that was a lot of what that report was about.
Yeah. The vast majority of mountaineering accidents happen on the way down from the mountain, not on the way up.
Good point.
Because of that complacency.
John, thanks very much.
You bet.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
And Dan Shapiro, we appreciate your time today as well.
Thanks so much.
Dan Shapiro is an assistant professor of clinical psychiatry at the University of Arizona in the College of Medicine. He's the author of the book Delivering Dr. Amelia. He was with us today from his office in Tucson.